Hi there, I'm Andy, and this is Cocktail Mode, the podcast where me and my co-host Dave take a classic video game and try and pair it with a great cocktail. This time out, we're talking about Broken Sword, Revolution's seminal point-and-click adventure game from 1996.
One thing I found this week, playing Broken Sword, looking up all the information, all that sort of stuff. 1996 is like the peak of culture in the UK.
That sounds about right, actually.
The music was great. The films were great. We had Euro 96. TV was really, really good. It's just one of the best years ever.
Yeah, it sits there in my brain as a fantastic year. Because the early 90s had some good stuff, but not much. And the mid sort of was better. And the end, it got a bit shit. But
well, plus as well, you've got to remember this is around the time that we're sort of starting to earn our own money and can go out and do things as
true.
Well.
Yeah, that is true.
So that's a big, big part of it. But yeah, great, great year.
96. Absolutely. I suppose all the early PlayStation games came out in 96, didn't they?
Yeah, it's when the PlayStation really sort of hit its stride.
Tomb Raider.
95 it came out. Tomb Raider came out just before Christmas, if I remember right.
Oh, right. I thought Tomb Raider was 96, but I got Outrun wrong. I can get anything wrong.
Yeah. It's like getting your own birthday wrong. But no, good years.
The first Resident Evil was 96.
Yep.
Tomb Raider was 96. Ridge Racer was 96.
Yep.
Motor Tune Grand Prix 2.
Wipeout 2097. Parappa the Rapper. Tomb Raider was late. 96, that would be when I got my PlayStation then.
It was a system seller for sure, that one.
It's what made me buy it. I went around to see a mate of mine that I hadn't seen for a while, Barry, and he just bought a PlayStation with a couple of other games, but he just bought Tomb Raider that day. And I played it for like half an hour, went home, bundled up my SNES, all the games, got the next bus into town, part exchanged it all, bought a PlayStation and Tomb Raider.
Yeah, I did that. We mentioned uni races in the last one. Don't know if it made the edit.
Oh, yeah.
But I stayed up almost all night trying to complete the one track that I'd not got a gold medal on before I traded it in.
Did you do it?
Yeah.
Oh, well done.
It was like a massive half pipe of a level, just up and down, and you had to score a ridiculous amount of points.
Yeah,
did it and then took it in and traded. I think I got about 60 quid for my SNES and all the games. An absolute con, but hey-ho. Tell you what, you say 96 was a good year. 97 was a great year as well.
Yeah, first and second year of that PlayStation era. Parappa the Rapper came out in 96 in Japan, 97 here.
Right, this is the top of my PlayStation list, and this is just in alphabetical order, not me picking the good ones.
Mm-hmm.
Ace Combat, Bushido Blade, Carnage Heart, Colony Wars, Croc, Doom, Einhander, Everybody's Golf, G-Police, Grand Theft Auto. And that's just in alphabetical order.
It's a long and distinguished list.
Like my Johnson. But on there as well, I mean, this is a better year. There's no denying that you got Parappa the Rapper, Soul Blade, Street Fighter, EX Plus Alpha, Time Crisis, Tobal Number 1.
Oh, Tobal. Great game.
Yeah. The first Toka came out in 97. Did you play much Toka?
A little bit, yeah. I remember really enjoying it. I remember it being quite hard.
Once you go up to speed, the cars are really twitchy. So you try and overtake someone and find yourself in a hedge. But if we do a Toka, possibly my mate who gave me the idea to start a podcast might come and be a guest host with us because he's well into his touring cars. So it'll be sort of aside from that era as well. He's done a podcast about classic touring cars and all sorts. And he plays a bit of games as well. So it'd be good to do that and get him on.
Give him a shout.
Done it all before. He's a pro.
1996 on MAME, what do we get? Dead or Alive?
I was about to say, I'm sure that's 97, but that's the PlayStation version is 97.
Die Hard Arcade?
Is it?
Do you ever play that?
Yeah, it's a great game.
It's dreadful. I hated it.
They've got it in CEX for the Sega Saturn at the minute, but it's 80 quid, so it's a bit of an investment. And my Saturn's in the loft, so I couldn't even play it if I were.
Another great arcade game from 96, Metal Slug.
Oh, that is great. Hard as fucking nails, aren't they?
They're good fun. I like them. In a MAME environment where you're not paying to play, they're great fun, but I'm not going to put money into an arcade machine to play that.
No, you're going to be very poor very quickly.
Mm.
There's loads of them, aren't there? I bought Metal Slug Anthology for the Wii a little while back. There were like, I think there's three or four different control systems they've put on it, and not a single one of them is just use a fucking gamepad. It's all. It's like use a little gamepad and then do a bit of waggle to throw a grenade or some shit like that. And it's so frustrating. It's such a shame. Just that they just use a gamepad.
Mm. But that was kind of the thing with the Wii, though, wasn't it? It was very much like, oh, we've come up with this, you know, interesting way to control games. We are going to use it.
Yeah, and I think, I don't know for sure, but it always felt to me like there must have been a bit of pressure from Nintendo to do it as well. But I love the Wii. The Wii has got far more fantastic games than it gets credits for. It has a fantastic version of MDK2.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's on the WiiWare thing, which was their download system. Mm-hmm. And the developers, it's a developer, isn't it? It's a guy. I can't remember who it is.
Was it Shiny? Shiny Games, wasn't it?
It might have been. Massively fell out with Nintendo in the development process. It sounds like a bit of a murky story, but the actual finished game, it uses IR controls, dot point and shoot, and it's so good. It just works so well.
Mm. It was Shiny, the company, the man that always used to really confuse me, founded and like the main guy, and it was Dave Perry.
Yes.
But not the Dave Perry that used to be on Games Master.
The one who got really grumpy when he fucked up Mario 64. Legendary bottom lipping of the highest order.
He was gypped. Yeah, Dominic Diamond moved to Canada.
Did he?
No, does radio in Canada.
Does he?
Yeah, and lives a simple life.
Oh, good for him. Hmm. I've always liked him because of Games Master, but he used to be on Radio 5. Mm. So on Saturday when I was working, we had Radio 5 on. I used to listen to him on there, and he was the one who pointed out that Alien Resurrection is a reworking of the Oedipus myth. I'd never thought about it before, and he's talking about it, and he goes, you know, he just almost apropos of nothing. He basically said, I went to see Alien Resurrection last night, and it was fantastic. I don't know why everyone hates it. Brilliant reworking of the Oedipus myth. And I went, ha! Huh, it is, isn't it? And I've loved it ever since.
Is that 96?
Oh, no.
97? It's around then, Alien Resurrection.
Really? In my brain, it's more turn of the century, but that was when I was picture framing, so it could have been 97.
97.
Look at that, bang on it.
Yeah. Tell you, 96,
yeah.
The peak of culture for the world. So yeah, just looking down the list of 1996 video games. There's a few Saturn ones on there. I guess the Saturn was still around for
it was
6 months of that year.
No, it was a weird thing, the Saturn. I don't know. I'm sure there is a well-rounded theory or some actual evidence as to why it died. But when it came out, loads of the games were still 2D, big in Japan.
Yep.
And Sega just seemed to be, you know, a bit of a shit show after the Mega Drive, didn't they? They didn't really seem to know what they wanted to do. They did the 32X and the Sega CD, and then the Saturn came and went in the blink of an eye, and then the Dreamcast came and went in the blink of an eye, and they just seemed to have a big, you know, almost like the Mega Drive was a bit of a fluke almost.
Yeah.
I remember quite clearly about reading stuff in magazines. I think it might have even been a magazine of yours, and it was just a little thing, and down the side of the page it had all these new, like the 32-bit consoles that were coming out.
Yes. I know. I remember this exact magazine. This is CVG from around 94, I think it is.
Yeah.
Because it's the Mega CD had come out. That it was a piece on the other systems that might come out.
Yeah.
And there was a PC Engine or similar sort of thing CD console. The Amiga CD32.
Yeah.
Had been announced or was out.
Yeah.
And then there was a thing about what would have been the Super CD.
Yeah. There was a Philips CDI as well.
Yeah. 3DO, the 3DI, yeah. Whichever one of those it was. But yeah, there was a tiny little bit in the bottom that said about the Sony PlayStation.
Yeah.
There's like after the split with Nintendo over the Super CD, Sony might end up making their own console. We don't expect much from it. So have you played Broken Sword sort of since we suggested it? And
yeah, I went back and refreshed my memory on the first two with videos, as you do, and mm-hmm. realised that everything I thought I remembered about Broken Sword 1 was from Broken Sword 2.
Oh, really?
Like everything, okay. Yeah. Like, I mean, everything. So I remembered we were by the docks at the beginning, there's the guard dog and the fence. And you have to get...
Yes, I remember that. I didn't remember that was Broken Sword 2. I thought that was a completely different game.
No, that's Broken Sword 2.
Ah, because I can remember that section was on a demo disc.
Yes.
one of the PlayStation Magazine demo discs. And I remember thinking it was Broken Sword, but then I couldn't remember that scene anywhere in the actual game.
Ah.
So I thought it's either, you know, sometimes they put together a demo for a game and then it doesn't come, that bit doesn't come out in the game. Yeah. I thought it was either that or a different game.
Charles Cecil wants us to stop calling them Broken Sword 1 and 2.
Okay.
That's all we're supposed to be calling them, Shadow of the Templars and something mirror, Smoking Mirror.
Smoking Mirror. Oh, do you know what Broken Sword's called in Germany?
I don't.
It's Baphomet's Fluch, which is Baphomet's Curse.
Oh.
And in France, it's Les Chevaliers de Baphomet, which is the Knights of Baphomet. Oh. It's basically been renamed in every other like language in the world. You know, sometimes you get a film that's got like the exact same title everywhere, but for some reason in the Philippines, they'll call it something else.
Yes.
I was expecting that, but every single language that this game has ever come out in, it's been renamed.
Have you ever heard the thing about pineapple?
I've heard some things about pineapple.
In every other language except English, pineapple is ananas or some version of ananas.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Anana or ananai, but it's all ananas and we go pineapple. Looks a bit like a pine cone and you can eat it. So, pineapple. Yes, Broken Sword. Charles Cecil wants them. They already had Broken Sword, the director's cut, which had new art and some new scenes, which gave Nico something to do. Because she did, and again, looking back at it, I didn't realise how little Nico actually did in Broken Sword 1.
Which I can only say is a good thing. Because I can't stand her. And this isn't just me. This isn't just like a controversial opinion of her. Everyone that I've spoken to about Broken Sword over the last sort of week or two has said how much they hate Nico.
But
just no one likes her. She's so miserable. The bits when you're in control of her, which I guess would be Broken Sword 2.
Yeah.
Anything you ask her to do, she says, no, that's what George would do. It's like, yeah, because George is more fun. George would show the tissue with the grease paint smear to every random stranger he meets until somebody says, oh, I need that. she's so miserable.
In Broken Sword 1, she literally sits in her apartment for the entire game until the very end.
Yes.
When she goes to Scotland with him.
Have you played the director's cut at all?
I did when it came out. I can't really remember much about it. I remember the sound. They didn't seem to bother remastering the sound for some weird reason.
No, they didn't do a lot with it, really. But there is apparently planned for this year a full HD reimagining of the original game.
Reforged, they're calling it.
And also a new game.
Yes.
Number 6 is apparently out this year at some point.
Parzival's Stone. I think it's Parzival's Stone, something like that. I don't really know. I saw an interview with somebody at, I think, Gamescom, and an interview with Charles Cecil in, honestly, what looks like a cupboard with a couple of Broken Sword posters hastily blue-tacked to the back of it.
Like when they used to interview footballers.
Yeah. But she sort of mentions, oh, Parzival Stone, what's the plot of that going to be about? And he goes on for about 10 minutes in like massive amounts of detail about the history behind everything that's going on. So he clearly gets really passionate about stuff like the Templars and like all that mythological stuff. I think he's really into that. And so I think it comes through, doesn't it? Because it's never sort of just a, oh, this is a fun name to call some stuff. There's always a bit of depth to it.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, is great. It brings the stories to life a bit, as well as the voice acting in the games, even in Broken Sword 1. I mean, way ahead of its time in terms of the quality of the voice acting, even though, you know, there are a lot of cultural stereotypes in that game. A lot.
Oh, God, yeah. It's I wouldn't say horribly racist, but, yeah, it's of its time, let's say. Yes,
it's never mean, really, is it? It's definitely a little bit culturally insensitive, but it's never mean. It's never like casting people as morons. I mean, George probably gets the roughest end of the stick as an American.
There is a great line right at the start of the original where when he first meets Nicole, he says to her, oh, you speak very good English for a French girl. And she goes, oh, thank you. You speak very good English for an American. And that had me in bits. I thought, oh, that's brilliant.
He says at one point, it's either like, I'm American, I'm innocent, or I'm innocent and I'm American. And whoever he's talking goes, make up your mind. But I think that's what,
brilliant.
To me, when you talk about Broken Sword and those games, people are always almost invariably bring up Monkey Island, and there's sort of a crossover. I think I've always preferred Broken Sword because it's a sense of humour that appeals to me more. And I think that, again, it's a culture thing. Monkey Island is, I assume, American, and Broken Sword is very... I also don't like that interface where you have like the verb interface. I forget what it's called. There's a name for it, isn't it?
Yeah, I know what you mean, and I don't know the actual name for it. It's the scum engine.
Yes, that whole thing.
Whether that's what you're thinking of.
Yeah, but it is. It's like where you have the in the bottom corner, or usually in the bottom left-hand corner, it says use it, throw it, whatever, and you can. And I don't get on with that interface. And it's obviously, you know, very much a personal thing what you prefer. But I much prefer the way Broken Sword works. And I think it probably, as much as I hate the term, closer to an interactive story than Monkey Island.
It's a difficult one to answer that because there's a lot to be said for both games in various areas. I mean, the original Monkey Island had no voice acting. It was all just text. So that Broken Sword has the massive advantage over that because you can read as much text and put on a funny accent in your head as much as you like. It's never going to replace somebody actually hearing somebody act and speak some lines.
No, and especially that well, isn't it? That quality of the voice acting is really high.
One of the things I did realise, the quality of the audio is awful.
Yeah.
In a lot of Broken Sword. It's all over the place. They must have been like really pressed to get it recorded and done.
I mean, it's almost as bad as our pilot episode.
Almost.
But no, you're right. And they didn't, and the same, when they did the director's cut, it's almost like they didn't bother to change much of it either. It still sounds really bad. But it's Broken Sword was the only game in the series that wasn't released under pressure for time. I think it was made sort of at the pace they wanted it to, but all the others.
Yeah.
Broken Sword 2, they had to borrow $200,000 to finish while the publisher raked in £10 million profit. Just the whole, around that time, the whole industry was upside down.
Yeah.
So publishers were getting all the money and developers were getting fuck all. So Broken Sword 2 happened like that. Broken Sword 3... Well, that might have been Broken Sword 3 I'm thinking of, actually. But have you played Broken Sword 3?
Very briefly. When it first came out, didn't appreciate the control method, didn't appreciate the changes they'd made, like everybody else that played it. As far as I can tell, well, no one rates it.
Well, I think you're wrong. I think, and to not to put too fine a point on your opinion, I think.
I mean, I'm not wrong. I'm just saying my opinion.
No, but I think when you say nobody liked it, I've looked back at reviews of it before I picked it up.
Okay.
It's actually reviewed pretty well, the third one. There were a couple of things that people don't like, the control method being the main one, because it's just weird. And there's a pretty much the second puzzle in the entire game I couldn't figure out how to complete because of the weird control system.
Is it a rock, like a climbing up a rock face section?
That's near the beginning.
I can remember that, and I think I may have got a little bit into it and then just stopped. I can't remember ever really I definitely never finished it. I don't remember getting far into it at all.
I think it's got all the qualities of the good. It's got all the good of Broken Sword. The voice acting's good, the story's good, and it's still funny, but it's also got this control scheme that just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
It works slightly better on a control pad than it does on a mouse and keyboard, which I think is probably why it even exists, because of the Xbox and the popularity of that and trying to make it work better. But it does this thing where you've got to highlight. If you've got more than one thing which highlights on the screen with like a little shiny star, you have to move your focus from one to the other, and it's not an intuitive way of doing it. So I was stood in this fucking aeroplane with a fire extinguisher in my hand trying to figure out how to throw it out a window. You've just got to shift the focus to the window and then click it. But then, after that is a bit you're talking about where you're around a cliff face, and it plays out a bit like a platformer, but with really weird controls. Like you walk and then you press a button to climb, then you walk a bit and then it'll be a different button to climb. It's just great. It absolutely blows your mind. But it does have, as I say, all the good of Broken Sword. So I haven't finished it yet, but I think I will. I think I'll stick with it. I'm already bored of the moving blocks around puzzles, and apparently that only gets worse as the game goes on. So sliding massive wooden crates around is kind of a thing, and his nibs, Charles Cecil, hates them as well. So I'm in good company at least, and as are we all.
I was going to say, is it Charles Cecil or Charles Cecil?
I think Cecil.
I'd say Cecil, yeah.
But he's done loads, hasn't he? He did, I didn't realise this, he did like an Amiga point-and-click game like years before he did Broken Sword, like 92 or something like that?
Yeah. Well, 92 is when he formed Revolution.
Oh, okay.
And started writing Broken Sword.
Yeah.
But yeah, Beneath a Steel Sky and Lure of the Temptress were the two big hits that they had before Broken Sword. I can remember playing Beneath a Steel Sky. But
it's one of those games that just gets so much love. It's almost like it's impossible to have an opinion on it that isn't just the greatest thing ever made, because it just gets, people adore it. And, you know, fair play to them, but I played about the first two or three screens and got stuck and probably wasn't in the mood, so never played it again. Probably on a phone or a tablet or something, because they did port a lot of them to, certainly to the iPhone.
Yeah, I was going to say the biggest selling version of Broken Sword is on the iPhone.
Is it?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't know that.
It's been massively successful.
The touchscreen works brilliantly for certain games, but they're not always the sort of game that you want to play in 5-10 minute bursts. And I would say that about Broken Sword. You want to sit down and relax and just get immersed in it, because they're, I mean,
you want an hour or two to try and get past that fucking goat. The thing that I love, and I go back to this a lot when I think about Broken Sword, the thing I love about it is that there's only one way to do everything, and you will try every other possible combination of everything until you finally get that little chime of music starts up to say, oh, well done. You've done a thing.
Apparently they're doing a thing in the new game, which I think sounds good. And I used to be the sort of thing that I'd get all puritanical about. But as you try different things, they're going to grey out on the menu.
Yeah.
So if you've tried combining that and that, it greys out. So you don't try it again. You know you've done it. It's just a visual cue, and you know you go and...
Yeah, the director's cut does that.
Does it? I don't remember that, but it's a great idea.
Yeah. And actually, the original does it with conversation options.
Yes.
When you're talking to somebody, you have like a list of options along the bottom. They're just icons of like people and things.
Yes, but, and they go down.
Yeah, they just vanish off the bottom once they're gone. So you don't end up asking them the same question 58 times in the hopes that the 59th time will be the right answer.
But if you didn't do that, you'd never have tried to feed a goat a piece of coal, would you?
You also wouldn't listen to all the various ways that George can describe a tissue with grease paint on it.
I mean, and none of them, here's a tissue with some clown's grease paint on it, which would be the sensible thing to do, not, what do you think of this dirty tissue?
One of my personal favourites is quite early on in Broken Sword, you find where the costume came from, the clown costume, and you go in there and you hand the tissue to the guy, and he goes, it describes exactly what kind of grease paint it is. You know, it's blah, 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 number 17 or whatever. Yeah. He's like, and he's the only person in the whole game who isn't repulsed by it.
And even after that, you keep showing it to every fucker.
Well, the thing is, you do.
Yeah.
George doesn't.
I guess he
does. Wouldn't. George wouldn't, but you specifically have got it in your head that you are going to show that dirty tissue to everyone you meet. Have you played much of 5?
I've played and completed 5. But
5 is brilliant because you get Trevor, the cockroach, that you can show to everybody.
I'd forgotten about that.
That's the thing I remember most from it. And then he finally has his hero moment where he does something for you that I can't remember.
No, I need to go back and play it, because I did really like it. I was...
It is very good.
It came out in 2 parts, and I remember thinking the second part seemed a lot shorter and a lot more confined than the first part. I think the first part you seem to have like 4 or 5 locations, and the second part like 2. Yeah, I think you started on the top of a building on fire, didn't you? And then you got a plane straight out to the desert or something, and that was where the game ended. And I just thought it felt like it came to an end pretty quick, because apparently what everyone says about 4 as well, and 4 is the game that was, everything was rushed. I haven't played Applaud. I haven't even watched a video of 4, to be honest with you. But apparently that was genuinely, they basically had to get it out and finish it and get some money in the bank so they didn't go bust, and they pretty much did anyway.
Yeah.
When everyone says that sort of it, the last act, it just kind of ends. And I felt a little bit like that about 5. Not the actual ending, but sort of the gap between the middle and the end seemed to sort of almost not exist. I accidentally discovered, when I was doing my research, I was sat and I had my Google on, and I was researching my train times to go to Exeter, which is where I've been this week for work.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And all at the same time, starting to do my research for this, and I accidentally typed Broken Sword into Google Maps. It's a tiny little village in Ohio.
Or called Broken Sword.
Called Broken Sword, awesome. Yeah.
I love it.
It seems to be like a crossroad of about 30 little houses just south of Lake Erie. I want to go in there and just walk around the town doing George Stobart quotes. Showing people a clown nose. What do you think of this?
Yeah. English man goes missing on holiday. One of the things I find from playing it again is very, very hard to say the lines to people who know the game without trying to put the accent on. And I just can't do it. I'm not even going to try it.
No, and because it's not like a particularly strong accent. It's not like a New York accent or some nonsense you can put on. It's just
exactly. Yeah, it's just kind of an average accent.
I've been meaning to look up actually where George is supposed to be from.
Oh, okay.
It's integral to my cocktail.
Oh,
choice.
Okay.
So if I've got it wrong, it could be trouble.
Idaho.
Oh shit.
Do you need to rewrite something before we carry on?
Now I shall crowbar it in another way. Don't you worry. It's funny when you were talking about not liking Nicole. I found the whole sort of the love story angle in the first one really weird because she never shows him any interest. They spend a grand total of about 5 minutes together in her apartment in the total of the game. Some of that's with another bloke there as well.
Andre.
Yes, Andre. And there's not really any hint of romantic interest at all, particularly from her. And then
there's nothing from her at all. But there's moments where George doesn't quite profess his love, but he just sort of say the thing, little bits and bobs like, I think I could fall for a woman like her and things like that.
Yeah.
But she's just nothing. She's just a cold fish for the whole game. And I think that's what the director's cut was for. I think they sort of looked back at it and thought, for where that ended up, she doesn't develop like he does.
No.
Realistically, there's only the bit at the end where she's really in the game at all.
Yeah, no, it is. Yeah, absolutely. So I say, she's sat at a table in an apartment for the entirety of the game.
Until you go to Scotland.
Yeah. So is the first Broken Sword your favourite?
It is purely for the nostalgia of it. Two, I remember looking forward to playing massively because the first one had been so good. It had been such a, you know, I'd played Monkey Island and other adventure games before, and to kind of just skip back a generation, text adventure games I used to enjoy on the 8-bit computers. So, yeah, kind of had a background in that kind of interactive story thing. But Broken Sword was such a departure from that. It was so good. It was so enjoyable with, you know, the sort of the march in technology to CD-ROM-based stuff where you could have proper music, you could have animation, you could have actual, you know, basically a cartoon. Yeah. But not necessarily a cartoon, more like an animated film, an almost mature animated film. Yeah, really looking forward to the second one. I can remember playing it, enjoying the entire game, but being really let down by the end. I feel like it's a bit of an anti-climax, if I remember right. I'd have to look it up or play it again.
I'm just trying to look at some stuff to jog my memory because I must admit I'm in the same place. And even though I said that most of my memories of the two games are Broken Sword 2, I can't quite remember the ending either. Mm. It probably backs you up without even having to look at it any further because if we can't remember it, the top post on the internet after Wikipedia and two YouTube videos is a Reddit post saying anyone else slightly disappointed by the ending.
There we go. Not just me.
But yeah, and I think it's right. It's a bit indicative that neither of us can really remember the ending of it. So it can't have been great, can it? Because you do. You remember the circle of chanting dudes from Broken Sword
blowing up a church.
Yes,
with no hesitation either from the from the French psychopath.
That again, there were a couple of bits I think where it doesn't quite come together, the situation in the gameplay and the animation, because they escape and they basically have to, there's two people between them and the door or something like that, and they get blown up.
Yeah,
but George and Nico somehow manage to get past them and get out. But
yeah,
it's not important. They all save the day, and you know, love conquers all, and everyone has a happy ending. And
except Khan. The guy who you spend the entire game chasing, thinking he's a cold-blooded killer, which he is, admittedly, but he's actually on your side, and he saves you.
Oh, is he the one in the robed guy who saves you at the end of that car?
Yes.
I've forgotten that. I knew there was a guy that appears out of pretty much nowhere, doesn't he? And saves you.
I could remember that there's basically a big twist where you assume for the entire game that the Templars are the good guys and that the sort of the various forces that are on either side are black and white when actually they're white and black. Mm. But yeah, I couldn't remember the specifics of it, so I did have to go back and finish it. Luckily, I had a save about, I don't know, three quarters of the way through the game.
That's cool. Nice.
On the director's cut. So, I'll just start from here because I can't remember the end at all, which is really useful. And then I started playing the original from the start for a few hours. And there's some stuff in between the goat and a possibly illegitimate Irish boy.
Is he the one who tells you a story and it's like, I can't remember it, but he tells you a story and like right at the end, it's like, oh no, he just made all that up or some shit like that.
Yeah, it's really strange. It's before the goat in Ireland, you're outside and then in the pub and you spend, I could be remember this entirely wrong and I wouldn't be surprised, but I'm sure you spend ages talking to this little kid outside the pub. And then when you go in, you ask somebody about him. And they just sort of say, oh, he's a compulsive liar. Don't believe anything he says.
Right.
So you're sucked in by this story. They just, I'll just ignore that then.
Again, I think that sort of sense you're about it, it's very self-aware, isn't it? That you're
yeah.
Of the fact that you're asking repeated questions and, you know, asking stupid questions and it doesn't flinch away from that. And I think that's part of what I like so much about it, because it is a ridiculous situation. As much as they're very sort of in-depth and well-written stories, the situations you're in are a little bit daft and it doesn't hide from that, and I like that a lot.
One thing I did take away from it though is there's nothing in the entire game that George does is superhuman.
No.
Like there's nothing like supernatural about anything he does. The only bit that you might sort of think twice about doing is climbing on top of a train.
Yes.
Other than that, everything he does, he gets, you know, goes down into a sewer, he sits down, climbs down the little ladder.
Yeah.
Like you would, like a real person would. He doesn't jump.
No.
You know, he doesn't jump off of cliffs or, you know, abseil down mountains or anything. He doesn't do anything stupid like jump out of a helicopter. Everything he does is rooted in reality.
Yeah.
There's very, very little sort of fantastical things in there.
Do you know what? I've just thought of this, and it's now I thought about it, it's really obvious, and I bet if I looked, there was a million people who said it before, and I'm not going to annoy myself a bit. But he's a very Hitchcockian hero, isn't he? He's very much
the everyman. Yeah,
he's very much of that ilk.
But that's part of the appeal, I think. He's not a superhero. He's not a detective. He's not, you know, fucking Batman. He's just a guy, a quite stupid guy sometimes.
Yeah,
but also a very innocent guy as well.
Yeah, he is. He's, you know, he's, and you say unlike Nico, he's friendly to everyone he meets at first. He's very judgmental. He's quite judgmental. He does, and based on appearances, I remember quite clearly he quite often describes people before he starts to talk to them, and it's not often kind.
No, but a lot of that you can't remember everything that you're hearing him say is his inner monologue.
Yeah, so basically he's secretly a prick, is what you're saying. So, do you remember the goat from Broken Sword 2?
I remember there was a callback to it, but I can't remember the specifics.
It's a different goat, and it's in the market.
So, how do you know?
Because it's a different colour, because the goat in... I went in a different country as well, so unless the goat's got itself a passport...
Does he, like, you click on it and he goes, I had a bad experience with a goat once.
Yes.
Or something like that. It makes some sort of reference to it.
He referenced it, but you keep... going, got all sorts of things you offer and it just basically ignores you and stares at you, and you offer it a piece of coal and it starts talking.
Okay.
It starts yakking away about how it prefers chocolate. I think it's any flavour chocolate's fine, but it's going to be nicer than coal. It's just bizarre. It's just such a great... And then after that, you go back and do it again and it just stops. You can't make it talk again. Once it's said its piece about liking chocolate or whatever it is, that's the end of it.
I don't remember that at all. I probably never did it.
Yeah, it's one of those random things. Because, you know, these days, there we go. You know about all the Easter eggs are all over the internet, aren't they? There's no surprises for anything. Mm. And that's one of those rare times. I haven't found many, but there are a few. like Easter eggs in games that I just found accidentally without knowing they were there, and that was one of the. But that's reminded me again in Broke Sword that I'd forgotten about, but when I've been mucking around, because I remembered there was a couple of old women in Broken Sword, and there's and he gets on brilliantly with both of them, and I don't know why I remembered that, but he does. They're two of the nicest female characters in the game.
Oh, it's the woman in the hotel, the old English dame. She's brilliant. She's got some fantastic lines.
She's from Hemel Hempstead, where I was born. I was born in Hemel Hempstead. She's like, how many games have got call outs to Hemel Hempstead in them? It's just brilliant.
You've got to think that somebody on the development team had like, let's come up with the most English sounding name we can find. What about Hemel Hempstead? Yeah, that'll do. It was either that or High Wycombe. Or Chipping Sudbury would have been a good one.
Oh, there's loads of stupid sounding names, isn't there? There's
just a few.
Interestingly, there's what I've played of three, because I've only played a little bit. But it's clear that there's a character in it they're referring to as Chummondly. It's a thing. It's like he tells somebody, because he dies quite early on. There's no spoiler. It's literally the first thing that happens in the game. And he's saying to somebody, like pretty much as he dies, that it's not Chummondly. I keep telling you. Because it's Chumley, isn't it? It's pronounced Chumley. And it's going to be a thing in the game. And it's just like, as an Englishman hearing it, you're just like, well, this is clearly going to be a thing that's happening. Whereas I can imagine in the rest of the world, it doesn't even register. It's just one of those bizarre things. But I tell you what, I know it's because, we have certain things we keep coming back to. And Flash Gordon is one I'm going to come back to now. Broken Sword 3 has an almost identical introduction as Flash Gordon. Honestly.
Please explain.
So it starts with a sinister character sort of talking about taking over the world, basically. The end is coming, wherever he is. And then your main hero gets in an aeroplane to fly off somewhere, and basically the aeroplane gets knocked out of the sky by weird lightning and crashes. It's fucking Flash Gordon. That's exactly the same.
It's exactly the same.
It's close enough that I went, that's fucking Flash Gordon.
It may well be a reference.
And then there is immediately a sliding block puzzle, and I'm not even joking.
Oh, well.
Although at that point, you don't realise that there is going to be about 15 of them every level.
Have you ever played Grim Fandango?
Not for very long. I played it on one of the, because it got re-released, didn't it? Not re-released, but
remaster about four or five years ago.
I played a bit of it, but I didn't get very far. I remember the last bit. I was on a rooftop somewhere and wasn't very far in, climbing up and down a drain pipe.
That's good. That's really enjoyable. I remember playing that similar thing with Broken Sword 3 when that came out. It had weird sort of tank controls, which I'm sure made sense to somebody at some point, but when they did the remaster, they just basically changed it to a point and click.
Yeah.
But that's a great story. That's really good. That's really good fun.
Yeah, it's one of those I should get back to. I don't often get the urge to play point and clicks anymore. But when I do enjoy them, I played one called Cafe Rain not so long ago.
Okay.
I think it's a fairly indie one. I say not so long ago. It's got to be at least a decade ago. And I played through that start to finish and really enjoyed it.
Just looking at it on Steam, similar to games you've played before, Secret of Monkey Island.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay, fair enough. Papers, Please.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You ever played Papers, Please?
I have, yes.
Fucking brilliant game. So depressing.
Yes. I've just finished playing his new game for the Playdate. You know the Playdate? Little thing with the crank on it.
No.
You've never heard of a Playdate. So it's a little handheld thing that came out a few years ago by a company called Panic, who make games.
With a crank on it?
Yes. Dave, straight to Google. But his Lucas Popes, who did Papers, Please, his new game's just come out on it, and it's like Papers, Please, Kids Edition, basically. It's called Mars After Midnight, but it's basically you as an alien creature of some sort and your robot therapist friend run sessions, like help sessions for various robots and aliens and things with like knife handling for gnats, and it's just really bizarre. And you have to just basically, they come to the door and there's like a flap, so with your little handle on your playdate you open the flap and you can just see them, and you have to decide whether they're fit to come in. And there's one that about boxing, I can't remember what it's actually called, beginner's boxing or something like that, and you have to equip like a fist, and as they come at the door you basically punch them in the face, and if they dodge it you can let them in because they're clearly it's very much like that sort of that whole idea, but made just really silly and really daft. Apparently he made it for his kids, but it's a really, really, there's lots and lots of games for the playdate, and they get in all sort of various forms of polish, and it's probably the most polished one I've played so far. It's really very good indeed. Mentioned before text adventures. Did you ever finish a text adventure game?
Technically, yes. I say technically yes because I had one on the Amstrad called Rydell's Revenge that the Amstrad magazine that I used to read, which I think was called Amstrad Action, printed in two parts over 2 months, a solution guide to the entire thing. It's the only one I ever finished. I did have a really, really randomly, I had a text adventure that I bought on the Amstrad called Kentilla. I can remember it to this day, but I think it's vaguely a fantasy sort of set game. There's definitely swords and weapons and things like that. And if you just pick the game up and start playing it, you don't get very far before you die. But if you look at the screenshots on the back of the cassette box, you can very clearly see on one of the screens, it says, say, Kentilla. So, well, I'll give it a go. A sword appears in your hand that kills everything you ever meet.
And I remember my brother having one on the Commodore 64 called The Pawn, P-A-W-N, not the other one.
Mm-hmm. I would have been surprised if it was just Pawn. I love the idea of text on a C64.
Thrust in. In the porn, there's a point where you find a boulder on a path and you've got like a rake and a spade or something like that, and you try and move it with a rake and it snaps. You try and move it with a spade and the spade snaps. And then you freeze to death on the mountainside because you can't move the boulder. And it can't have been a guy. So it's such an obscure game, but I must have figured out that you take your jeans off and tie the spade and the rake together and then leave the boulder out of the way.
Oh, God.
And then you die of hypothermia because you're hanging around in your pants on a mountainside. I, like you, finished exactly one text adventure and only finished exactly one text adventure because I had a guide. But I earned my guide.
You earned your guide.
It was a big... like a not a big box, not like a big cardboard box Spectrum game, but
yeah, the double tape
called things. Aftershock, yeah. Which is set after an earthquake, and you had to get somewhere or other. And I played it for a bit, and I kept on getting stuck in this flipping sewer system. So I went, I looked on the box, and there was an address. So I wrote a letter. I don't know if I had a word processor or anything like that at the time. I can't remember, but I wrote him a letter that said, really enjoying this game. I've got to this bit and I'm stuck. Are you able to give me any help? And they sent back about 30 or 40 typed A4 pages and an entire walkthrough for the game.
Wow, that's awesome.
Isn't that great? Now, I wish I still had it.
What company was it? Can you remember?
Some absolute nobody company. It was probably just some kid in his bedroom. But
yeah, probably.
It might be on World of Spectrum, actually.
What was the game called? Aftershock. Interceptor Software. Author David Banner.
Ha!
He's busy these days with gamma research.
Apparently, there's been talk of a Broken Sword film.
There's been talk of a Broken Sword film since 2007. Okay. I don't think it's going to happen. It's one of the things that I found out. I was looking through a website that won't be named. That's it. Broken Sword film. Ooh, that's a dreadful idea. I hope nobody ever makes that. Because it would be. I don't think it'd work. It wouldn't work. They'd be crowbarring stuff in, jokes that would seem out of place. Because the overall tone of the games, they are actually quite serious and dark.
Yeah.
And the humour is there to alleviate that. I think if you tried to make a film, it wouldn't know what it is. It would have, what's the phrase? Tonal inconsistency.
That thing I hate.
No, it would. It would have to flip flop between being like absurdly funny and deadly serious. And it just, I don't think it'd work.
To be fair, I think it's probably something the games don't get enough credit for, because they pull that off, don't they?
Oh, very well.
I mean, because if I remember right, doesn't George at the end almost sort of join the baddies just before it all goes wrong?
Not really. I finished it like a day ago. Oh, trust me.
So in my head, what happened was that they say basically join us because we're not all bad. And then he's about to, and then he realized that they've been murdering people for the entire duration of the game and goes, oh, hang on, no, you're not the good guys after all, are you? And then again, that guy who I didn't remember comes and saves him and then dies very quickly.
No, he's already dead by then.
Oh, is he?
Yeah. He gives them a bag of C4, which they use to escape and blow up the bad guys.
That's what's in, because I remember Nicole throws her handbag, and I remember there was something explosive in there. I thought it was a hand grenade or something.
No, they're in an old like Civil War ammo dump, and the bad guy says something like, oh, yeah, all this old gunpowder's been sat around for hundreds of years. It's not of any threat to us or something. And she's like, no, but this stuff is. And Chuck says, it's a bit hammy, but it's all good.
When is it you're off to the Olympics? I know you tell me every time.
Start of August. One of the things I'm going to be doing is visiting Harry's Bar.
Yes.
Which is going to come up in a little while, because we'll have to talk about these cocktails in a bit.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons I sort of had Broken Sword in mind to talk about, because Paris is very much in my head at the moment.
Yes. And it's interesting, isn't it? Basically, it's a British-made game with an American protagonist set for the most part in France. Mm. It's an unusual thing, isn't it? And it's such a big part of the game.
Well, one of the things I would say about that, and you only really notice it when you start playing it properly and actually paying attention to everything, it doesn't ever, other than the end in the director's cut, actually use any real Paris locations. The map does show the Eiffel Tower, the Arc de Triomphe, Notre Dame, the Bastille, you know, some big famous landmarks, Moulin Rouge, but they're not there. They're not in the game. You set anything in Paris, you will use one of the famous locations at some point. You have to.
Yeah.
Because that's what people know from it. And it doesn't ever do that.
I kind of love that.
I do like that. I think that's really good. Because without using the famous landmarks of the city, they've captured the look of that city very well.
But you had very neatly crowbarred us onto cocktails, and then we got distracted again.
I was trying to.
Yeah, you had. So you were saying that about Harry's Bar.
Yes, Harry's Bar in Paris was responsible for a lot of cocktails being created. Yeah, and linking Broken Sword to a cocktail, the game goes all over the place, ends in Scotland, but for me, it's a game set in Paris.
Yes.
What you remember of the game, other than the goat, is Paris. Even though, like we said, there's no real locations used, but it feels right. It feels like it's set there, and it just works for me. So as soon as I thought Paris, cocktails, Harry's Bar. It's the only option I've got. So I thought, right, go on the Harry's Bar website. I could buy the book that cost £200 and it's very, very rare, apparently. But I'm not going to. So I'll go on the website. So, yeah, just flicking through. And there are quite a few on there, ones that Harry invented, or that were invented in Harry's Bar. But I've gone for the Blue Lagoon, because out of all of the ones on there, it's the one that I think actually sounds like it tastes nice. Because I will try a few of these when I actually go to Paris and visit Harry's Bar again. To my eternal shame, the time I went there, I had literally fuck all money.
It's not cheap, is it? I know other people have been there and it is not cheap.
I had half a pint of Heineken that cost €7.
Jesus Christ.
That's 10 years ago. That's probably going to be more like a tenner for a half a pint now.
God.
But yeah, I went for the Blue Lagoon, mainly made in Paris. And it's going to be one of those drinks that you sit there in an institute in Paris and just think, this is exactly what George Stobart would have bought here. Out of all of the ones there. I mean, they did invent the sidecar.
Did they
going
really?
Going back to one of your previous mentions.
Yeah, sumo in a sidecar. We talked about for Street Fighter 2.
And there are a few on here that sound really nice that I'm going to have a try of, but I went for the Blue Lagoon because it's something I think I can actually make with ingredients I've got myself. Yeah, it's vodka, blue curacao, and grapefruit or lemon juice. So it's very simple. Yeah, it feels
a tall
right.
drink, isn't it, Blue Lagoon?
Yeah, it can be. You can have it in a massive bowl as well if you want and have like four straws, I think. It's one of those, it's so simple, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
There's very little artistry that goes into
bit
it.
Bit like George Stobart, right?
Yes, but it looks like the one that George Stobart would pick out of all of these.
He's a simple soul. But I think we chatting before about him, I think he's such a great character, and it is. I'm ashamed of myself for not pinning the term Hitchcockian on him before, but it's because it's exactly what he is. And yeah. I'm unconvinced he would pick a bright blue cocktail. I think every man, George from Idaho, certainly at that point in his career. I don't think I like it. I like it. I had two that I was going to look at, and I'm going to switch to the other one because I made a mistake with George's geographical heritage. I think at the start of three, he's working in New York.
Oh, okay.
As a patent lawyer or something bizarre like that.
Oh, like Einstein did.
Maybe that's where it comes from.
Could be.
I don't know. But yeah, so there is a French Manhattan. It's a version of a Manhattan. So that was my choice, but I thought it was because that's where he was from, but apparently that's not where he's from. So I think I should go for my second choice. I leaned away from it originally because it's just a bit too basic sounding, and not as a cocktail, but as a link, because it's just called the Parisian.
Mm-hmm.
For much the same reason as you did, because yeah. I like you. If you know, before I started sort of looking into it and remembering, I barely remembered any of the other locations in Broken Sword.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a French game, you're right. And if someone had told me that it was French, I would have believed them. You know what I mean? I really would. It's a big part of the game. And it'd be a big part. I guess Nico helps with that because apparently she's been played in every game. A different actress has played Nico every single time. So yeah, George has always been the same and she's been different every time. I wonder if that's about sort of voice age.
Maybe as part of his salary, he gets to keep them in some sort of bizarre dungeon. They have to be sacrificed to the soul of George Stobart.
And correct me if I'm wrong, because you finished it very recently and I haven't, but when they're on that train, she gets handcuffed and he basically forces himself on her and kisses her when she can't defend herself?
Yes, it's as he's letting her out of the handcuffs.
Right.
He does say, or she says something about it, and he's like, oh, I couldn't help myself.
Ick.
It's not rapey. These days, it would be considered it.
I think if it would be considered so these days, it probably should have been considered so in 1996. Just we were too fucking stupid to go, oh, do you know what? In all those Bond films where he basically rapes people, it's fun, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Probably on us for not being a bit more aware. But anyway, yeah, I went for the Parisian cocktail because one of the reasons we went for this is because we were talking last time out or the time before coming, which that I have basically 20 years supply of creme de cassis in my cupboard where I made it. And this is another cocktail.
Desperately trying to get rid of
it. Really simple cocktail. Gin, dry vermouth and creme de cassis. And you don't even shake it, stirred in a glass. And it's because I have the creme de cassis, I did give it a shot and it's very, very nice. The vermouth is quite strong in it because vermouth is normally just sort of a background thing. It's used to either dry or sweeten cocktails up, but it's quite winey as a flavour that comes through, which I don't always like, but I think because of the creme de cassis. So yeah, because then we're on the same page, we've come from the same direction, and I've got time for that as well.
I think if you said to anybody, what out of Broken Sword do you take away the most? Paris would always be the answer.
Yeah.
So it's got to be the thing you key in on.
Yeah, that or the fucking goat.
There aren't that many goat-related cocktails. I looked. I tried.
Back with our friend, Mr. Simon Diffin, and his wonderful website, Difford's Guide. I would love us to get sponsored. We're not. There are two cocktails on there that mention goats. There's Negroni and the goat, for some reason.
Shit, I clearly didn't look. Because that would be the first place.
Negroni and the goat. But actually, no, now looking at it, that's the only cocktail with the name, with the word goat in it. And it's got fucking Aperol in it, which is horrid.
It's got what?
Aperol. Okay. So over the last 10 years, the Aperol Spritz has been a thing that is a cocktail that shows up everywhere, and it's vile. It tastes like cough medicine.
What is it?
It's just Aperol is a particular liqueur, and you just have it with tonic water or lemonade or something, and that's an Aperol Spritz.
Oh, yeah, I've seen the bottle.
Vile, yeah. But yeah, that's the only cocktail with a reference to a goat in it. Gin, Aperol, sweet vermouth, and Averno Amaro, which I would imagine is some sort of amaretto flavour. We've got to give a shout out to that, and we go. And apparently it's very nice. It's getting a 4.5 out of 5 on Difford's Guide. Apparently it's good.
Yeah. How many cocktails are on Difford's Guide?
Thousands. Genuinely thousands. The book has got thousands, let alone the website.
One of the places I think I've said about it before on a podcast, a place in Leicester called Firebug. They got the Cocktail Mode arcade machines still.
Yes.
They do and have done for years a cocktail of the week. And they're very often themed around like a film that's coming out or a game or something like that. So there's been Turtles ones, there's been Barbie ones. But they've got, and I have to use finger quotes for this, the book. Behind the bar somewhere, there is a random folder full of handwritten notes of all of these going back years.
That's brilliant.
And I went in there once and I said to them, have you still got the ingredients for the Shredder, which was a Turtles related one? And it's a little shooter, but I think it's Midori and a raspberry liqueur and probably one or two other ingredients. It's fucking amazing. And they were like, oh yeah, it's in the book. And literally the pause between the book. Like, did you just make sounds to do finger quotes? It's in the book. So it became like a really big thing. It's like, oh, what's this week's cocktail?
That's cool.
Yeah, you'd look forward to going in there to see what it was. Yeah. And that's kind of the basis of my experience with cocktails.
Nice.
It's that every week go into Firebug. Oh, what's this week's cocktail?
Yeah, I mean, I think I mentioned before, I get quite sort of old school with most of the things. So I get a bit classic. I love getting cocktails out of Harry Craddock's book and all that. But I do like some, especially if they know what they're doing.
Oh, they definitely do.
Because, I mean, I've tried to make sort of mix up stuff before and it's been vile. Although it did, when I was up with Greg and Jason a couple of weeks back, they brought a bottle of Prosecco to celebrate me getting my job, and Jason's changing jobs soon as well. So we thought, we'll get a bottle of Prosecco. And then they were like, do you know any Prosecco cocktails? And I was like, well, you get a French 75. That's nice. It's simple. And it's gin, lemon juice, a bit of syrup, and top it up with champagne. Easy as that. Mm-hmm. But they had no lemon juice, but they had lime juice. So we used that instead. And it was bloody lovely. And we were like, oh, we'll call it the Speyside 37.5. Rather than... And then I Googled it, and it already exists.
Yeah.
Hilariously, it's called the Bastard French 75.
Brilliant.
The next episode is going to be on the best arcade light gun game ever made, Time Crisis, potentially bettered by its sequel, but I'm sure we'll have a yak about that as well, because those two games are both masterpieces. And if you think Virtua Striker, I nearly said that.
Virtual Tennis.
Virtual On, Ontario Tangrab.
Oh, wow.
Thank you very much.
That's a random reference.
If you think Virtual Cop is better, then tune in. Find out why you're wrong in the humble opinion of me. And Dave, do you agree with that, Dave?
I've got no real opinion on Virtual Cop. I never played it. Played Lethal Enforcers quite a bit.
Yeah, that's a very different one as well, isn't it?
And I can remember playing one of the very, very early CD-based games, which is Mad Dog McCree.
Yeah.
It's like a Laserdisc game, I think.
Yeah, doesn't that feature in Back to the Future 2?
I don't think so.
It was a bit at the beginning of Back to the Future 2.
He plays a Western shooting game. I don't think it's Mad Dog McCree.
And you have to use your hands. It's like a baby's toy.
Do you know who that is? Do you know who that kid is?
No.
And it's not Mini Driver this fucking week either. Or Andy McDowell. It's Elijah Wood.
No.
Yep.
Bloody hell. So for more of that nonsense, join us next time when we'll talk about how amazing the Time Crisis games are and what a terrible loss to the world the lack of CRTVs has become. So yeah, that'll be next time we're out, which will be at most 2 weeks. So see you then.
Bye.